Clubhouse. April is for Apple. Apple TV Plus, that is. Each week in April, our Love It or Leave It episodes will be featuring original movies and TV series streaming on Apple TV Plus right now.
Welcome to Apple in April. This month, we're talking movies and TV shows on Apple TV Plus. This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
This is Sheila. And today we're going to be talking about Apple TV Plus's movie Cherry, which debuted in March 2021. And this movie is directed by the famed Russo brothers, Joseph and Anthony Russo. And it is written by sister Angela Russo Ostad and Jessica Goldberg. And it's based on the 2018 autobiographical novel by Nico Walker. He was in the U.S. Army and he was serving in Iraq. And apparently he was in more than 200 combat missions between 2005 and 2006, which explains an awful lot.
Oh, my.
Yeah, the short write-up on IMDb says, Cherry drifts from college dropout to army medic in Iraq, anchored only by his true love, Emily. But after returning from the war with PTSD, his life spirals into drugs and crime as he struggles to find his place in the world.
Wow. That's pretty accurate, right?
Yeah, sometimes, I was going to say. Yeah.
Sometimes these are kind of bad, right? Sometimes they're like, a man finds a horse. This one is actually, that's pretty right on what goes on in this one. I think it's really helpful to know that this one is based on a true story. And while they may have taken some amount of license in, you know, different things, of course, we know in the way that the movie was shot, they added some layers of sort of surrealism. I'm sure he wasn't doing exactly everything all this way. But I think it's super interesting to know that this man actually lived this life. What did you think, Sheila, about the casting of Tom Holland for this main character, who we don't have his name? He is referred to as Cherry in the credits, but never do we get a first or last name for him.
Yeah, so actually, after I watched the movie, I was like, do we actually know what his name was? Because I noted on his fatigues, like on his army uniform, anytime it was referenced, he would always said soldier. Dives into other questions that I had about the tone of the movie and the relation to identity, and we can get into that later. But yeah, overall, I thought the casting of this, when I saw the picture of the author, I was like, wow, I was like, that is a really close mark to Tom Holland. So I think the casting in that aspect was really on the mark for the main character. I liked this cast. I liked Emily, his love interest, and she was just like this adorable girl next door love interest that you couldn't help but adore her. I mean, I did. And then until she, you know, turned. But
oh no, a little zombie-esque, huh? She's turned. Paul, what do you think? I know that you have a long history with Tom Holland within the superhero world. How did you feel seeing him dragging himself through the desert and with a needle in his arm?
To be honest, it bummed me out a little bit. And I think after seeing Tom in more grown-up roles like this, it's going to be tough if the next Spider-Man movie I watch, they try to put him back in high school. You know what I mean? Because I've seen him do this stuff. It's going to be harder to buy him as a kid, especially, I mean, he does not look like a kid anymore. His face is not smooth teenager type skin anymore.
So he was 23 in shooting this film. Which is actually the accurate age of when the character starts in the movie as well. So I agree with you that he looks older and he's definitely missing his spidey sweetness, I would say. So it is hard. I mean, we always go through that though, right? When you have a character who's grown up in front of us. I mean, he's part of a franchise right now where he's still supposed to play a really innocent guy. How are we going to go back and believe that? Has he kind of messed that up?
It's something that you might have seen with all of the Harry Potter cast, where after they were done with that, they began to take
a little spring awakening action.
Well, full grown roles, you know.
Oh, you know what? You chose your words really, really perfectly there. Because
you like that?
Daniel Radcliffe went in to do this Broadway production of Equus, and he did some full frontal nudity. Mm-hmm. And people were just like, oh,
Harry Potter.
Put that bushel under a light again.
Harry Potter. Oh, my God.
Yeah, the little Harry Potter's out now.
Exactly.
Waving around like a wand.
Oh my God. Too much. Oh my
but gosh. I did like to see the fact that he was trying to shed that superhero designation because, you know, too often actors are pigeonholed. I like when people like go out and flex their muscles just to show that they can do something other than what they're really well known for. It's a dangerous and slippery slope for some actors, I think.
Because he was the main character for us. I mean, he really is the movie. So in just talking about him, and I'm going to refer to him, I guess, as Jerry, because I don't want to refer to him as the main character the whole time. You know, I feel like we need to talk about more about the plot and what we thought about it and how we felt about taking this journey with Cherry. Because you guys, I got to say this. For me, I was like, this was a journey. Okay. I took this journey. When it was done, I was exhausted. I needed like some Gatorade to replenish my electrolytes. I was so freaking exhausted. I'd been through a lot. So, Paul, I'm going to ask you, what did you think about the plot of this movie? Just, you can talk as generally as you want. You can give up a little bit of information, however in depth you'd like to go.
Well, I understand that it's based on real events. So, critiquing the plot itself is probably pointless because if it happened, even if there were other things that kind of swam in and out of these events, these events more or less probably still happened. So, that doesn't seem particularly worthwhile. There were other parts of the presentation of it that I had, I don't think that's the right way to approach it, but it's more like the tone couldn't decide where it wanted to be. There were a lot of sight gags.
I liked the bank.
but this wasn't really like a gag-oriented movie. It was like maybe they thought having those sight gags would help kind of balance out the serious tone of the rest of the stuff that happens. But I don't know that you can do it when you're talking about heroin addiction by having Soldier on your nameplate or the bank or you know what I mean?
Right. I don't know that's
whomever.
Yeah. Or doing the robot is the part I was thinking of actually being designated doing the robot.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I agree. The Dr. Whomever was funny on the little nameplate. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So, I mean, Sheila, what do you think? Was that disorienting to be like sort of in this very serious? I mean, I felt it. Every time, you guys, there were real needles used. This was not like one of those where, oh, it like retracts inside the thing. No, they're using real needles in this. And like when those things were happening, I mean, my body was really reacting. It was very visceral for me. So then to have one of those moments where mostly it was me or Paul yelling it out to the other, like, oh my God, it says the bank on it. Like, what was the one that said like this? There was like the second or third bank he did. It had some other name.
Oh, there was like Shitty Bank.
Yeah. The one that you were like yelling about. And I was like,
and then there was like a bank, like Bank Fucks America, right? Yes, you know, there's Capitalist One. There was a lot of name play here. You know, Paul, like what you said, that's where I was struggling with this movie was like, is it satire? Is it meant to be funny? Is it meant to be like a rebuke on the institution, the infrastructure that brought us to this point where these boys are being sent off to, and I'm saying boys, but like these are my contemporaries. They're our contemporaries because we're all around the same age group. These people in 2002, I was 23 in 2002. I am the same age basically when this guy goes off to war at this, like, you know, his contemporary at that time. In hindsight, like, yeah, these babies are going off to war, but they were our friends. My brother was sent to Iraq. He enlisted in the Navy as an officer, and he was flying in planes over the Persian Gulf and doing all kinds of things. So it's interesting to watch it from that perspective. It was hard to watch for me certain times just because of things that he's told me about what has happened over there. But I couldn't decide like where this movie was trying to direct us. Like, is it a satire? Is it a war story? Is it both? But it, for me, it just didn't really kind of like cross the finish line with any of those genres. Like, I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. So talk about the Russos a little bit, because when you just said directs us, you know, I know that there's a lot of history with the Russos. Paul, what do you feel about that? Do you think that their hand in this kind of pushed this tone to a place where couldn't quite decide?
Probably, in that before they became a household directing pair from doing four of the most successful Marvel movies, including Infinity War and Endgame, they were executive producers and writers for Community. Community is pretty famous for having sight gags and stuff happening in the background that you don't notice, like the whole bit of Abed delivering a woman's baby, but it happens only in the background. It's never in the foreground. And at the end of the episode, it's something like, yeah, I delivered a baby today or something like that. And you would have to only have paid attention to what was happening behind the main action in order to know that that even happened. So they come from that. And so that's not totally out of character for what they want to put into a story.
How does that work, though, when you're telling a real story and you're telling very difficult, tragic stories of real soldiers and real drug addicts? How does that work? Does that add a layer of interest, or is it somehow disrespectful to those people's challenges? When you're kind of adding this layer of like, we're kind of laughing at things happening around you. Is that okay or not okay?
Perhaps. And this is probably something that has to do with just a disconnect that I had with the movie. But it opens with a monologue where he explains how he perceives his place in the world and how he kind of feels disconnected from it at all. I was looking the whole time for something to chalk that up to, whether it was some kind of emotional or psychiatric type diagnosis or something that would kind of match up with feeling disconnected like that, or if it was something else. And it never manifested in his personality, but it did manifest in these moments of not really caring what these other people's names were, not telling us his name, not, you know, absorbing the banks and stuff that he was robbing. You know, if you rob a person at gunpoint, you're affecting their life for the rest of their lives.
Even that was fascinating. You know? Like, I'm kind of curious if that's how chill a teller acts or not, because again, it's messing with me about how much is this real. And how much is this sort of like, you know, they're taking their own license? Like, do tellers just hand over a chunk of cash? I mean, I believe that's probably true. Sheila, yeah. What do you feel about that?
This is where I was taken with, like, is this like meant to be a satire on capitalism and sort of like this rebuke on like the infrastructure that sends these people, you know, to do these horrible things? So even like with the tellers, like them handing over the money, and there's even an exchange at some point where they say, like, it's not really their money. Like, it's, you know, it's not really our money. It's the bank's money. But really, when it comes down to it, yeah, it's your money. But like the fact that like the banks were so cold and callous didn't really make me feel all that bad for the bank. I felt bad for the teller who had the gun in her face. I think her name was Vanessa. She's the only one that really had a name, I think, with the exception of like Emily. But as far as, can you really root for a bank, which represents like what's so wrong with society? Like early on in the movie where he's trying to like fight a transaction fee that was lodged on his account.
Oh my God. How much did y'all feel for him? I can remember being that age and being like, but it was your transaction fee that put us in the overdraft.
Like, right?
I can remember having that. Yes.
Like, I can't afford that $25 right now, friend. You know,
oh, it's
like,
so messy because Paul and I were married at that point. And so we were married at 21. So we were the babies there, but married and trying to be like grown-ups, and we were so not grown-ups. And, you know, we're like, we have a mortgage and like we have all this stuff and we don't even know what we're doing. No one, I don't even know if we knew how to like balance a checkbook,
right.
But we have
all
these responsibilities.
I had to be like, what's escrow? I was like, what's escrow?
Yeah, I mean, I was like, we're in escrow, like totally like TJ on Gilmore Girls, we're in escrow. And it was totally like that, like what the hell? But I felt for him so much, and little moments like that felt incredibly real. Even the going back to all the guys playing games, you know, back at sort of like the flop house kind of feel where everyone's not really sure what to do. We had that exact night where one of our friends said, I joined the army today. And in that exact thing where all the guys were gaming and we were all sitting around and I was like, I'm pregnant.
And I'm off to war.
Yeah. And it was like, oh my gosh, like everyone was just kind of like going into these like crazy moments, but those were real, you know?
Yeah.
That mix of guys still wanting to sit around eating, you know, Taco Bell and play video games, and we're about to be having the most biggest responsibilities of their lives.
Right. So like when he started knocking off the banks later on, I couldn't really feel bad for the banks because like you're kind of the ones who set him up for this, right? Like, you know, you screwed him over early on. So there's like this lingering taste in his mouth. And even when he tries to, you know, fight for his friend and he's like, you're an asshole. Like, I don't want to talk to the manager. I am the manager. Oh, well, you're still an asshole. You know, so I can't really feel bad for the bank entity. And that's where like I keep coming back to, like I, you know, mentioned earlier, the identity in this movie. Like it's everyone's story and no one's story all at the same time, because nobody's given a bank. Like, we learned that it's Cleveland that he's living in, but it really could be like any town USA. And I think that's really what the story is telling you, is like, this could be anybody.
And I appreciated that. And you're so right. Like, the patch on his uniform saying soldier, it wasn't important. It could have been our friend Alex. It could have been your brother. It could have been anyone. Right. It wasn't important what his name was. It was that this is a very real series of events that could happen. And, you know, making that split second decision based on a girl, basically, to join the army, I think we saw that happening, you know, where people were just like, you know, I don't really have a direction. I don't have a purpose. I don't really know what I'm doing. So I guess I'm going to join up.
And I 100% saw, I'm going off to war. I'm being deployed. Let's get married.
Oh, yes. Us too. Yes.
That was huge at that time.
Too. Will you get more money if you're married?
Well, then the spouse is also taken care of. There's housing allowance. There's
insurance, right?
There's a ton of benefits now that come with being, you know, franchised into this, you know, larger, what is it, military industrial complex, right? So you get like an entire, you get an entire new identity.
You do. I mean, and I mean, of course, that's, I love that you're talking about identity, because I mean, the directorial choice to have the teller's face be completely blacked out in that transaction. Yes. Oh my gosh, that was so real for me, because it is just so faceless. Again, being that young, the world and all the adults seem just like one Charlie Brown,
I was about to say the Charlie Brown teacher, adult is like,
I don't know what you're saying, transaction fee.
You're an asshole. Like, just let me talk to your manager.
Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, I appreciated that on so many levels. I hope that people these days can. I'm wondering if teens or young 20s people, even a little older than that, I guess, are going to be able to appreciate this the same way that we do, because we did live this. Do you think that people that these days are going to say, I'm 23, nobody's joining up to go to war. This doesn't feel real. This doesn't feel like something that I can relate to. What do you guys think about that?
You know, that's an interesting point that I kind of came away with. I was like, is this going to matter to people who are a generation younger than us? And I'm going to say generation because like we're all in the same age group. I would say people 5 years younger than us who were like at the 17-year-old in 2002, 2003, or maybe even a little bit younger than that, maybe the beginning of high school, they were 10 years removed from a lot of their friends going off to war, right? So I don't know if people who are younger than us are going to be able to, especially not in a 23-year-old range right now. I don't think a 23-year-old is going to watch this movie and have the same feelings that we feel. Because we can now, like, we can take a step back in time and be like, oh my God, like, you remember that night that we said we were pregnant and he said he was going off to war? I remember when September 11th happened. My brother had already, you know, signed on with the Navy. I called it the betrothal. They had a long engagement and they were paying for like some of his college tuition based on the fact that he would graduate and go into the Navy. And then when 9/11 happened, I just looked at him. I was like, what the fuck does this mean now? Like, you're going to go into like literally like I'm still processing the fact that there's dust everywhere in my city. Now my brother, he can't go back on his promise. Like, he signed a contract with the Navy. And now all of a sudden today in 2 hours, his entire future has changed. Mm-hmm. Terrifying. On top of everything that was happening that day, I was like, you got to get out of this. Like, you can't go now. And he was supposed to go into basic training this September 16th, like the following week. Couldn't go because the orders in which for he had to, you know, go down and receive were on Maiden Lane, which was destroyed. The recruiting office that he'd gone to was destroyed. So he had to like wait an extra week. Because they had to like reissue orders and it had to come from Washington. It was like this whole big thing. There's a lot of emotion that's tied up in this that I just really don't know if people who didn't live through that at this point, like, are going to, and I'm going to say younger than us because they have not had the same connections and whatnot to war. And I would say the generation above us, with Vietnam being something that was maybe a generation removed from us. And even like the first Iraq war, for people who kind of like bridged that gap in the middle, they'll all have stories to relate to this and times to relate back to. But I don't know if people younger than us are going to have the same draw to this movie. They might because of Tom Holland and they're just like, hey, it's Spider-Man. And oh, Spider-Man goes off to war. I don't know if I like this. Spider-Man with a needle in his arm is not something I signed on for.
Well, and having said that, I mean, I do think they did a great job of actually showing the grittiness of, you know, what it is to be in basic training, what it is to go off to war, how gruesome it is. I thought it was fascinating that they made him a medic. Again, it's a little hard because it's like, if this was this man's real story, Nico Walker, it's a little hard to be like, what an interesting choice to have made him a medic. Like, right. Well, if this is this man's story, this is this man's story. But I guess we kind of do have to talk about the fact that most of the time in movies like this, they do change up things. Now, maybe they did not at all in this one, but it still is a choice to have left him a medic, I guess. I want to say it that way.
It's funny that you use that word, Caroline, gritty, because that's exactly what I put in my notes. I was like, it's gritty. It shows the honest.
I like live under your bed, Sheila. Like, I know a lot of stuff of what you're doing.
So. I typed it. I didn't say it out loud. So that means that you're in my head.
When you're sleeping, I like peep on shit.
I actually had to watch it in two sittings. I couldn't watch it the whole way through the first time. Wow. So I liked the little vignettes, and it was just like, okay, I'm going to stop here because I need a break. Mm. Like when you said you needed Gatorade, I'm like, I need a break. I need a break from this movie.
Well, did you feel like how they broke it down into part one, part two, epilogue, all that business? Like, did you feel like that was advantageous to the storytelling?
I didn't need it, but it made it stylish, you know, because it fit within sort of a visual motif that they kept using. And with, you know, like the red, obviously cherry, big iconic coloration, and then the letters and all that. So it helped tie everything together and let you know where you were in the story. You know, I didn't have a big problem with that choice. And I tend to enjoy movies that have some visual style to them. So, yeah, that was a cool part for me. When you guys were talking about the war, though, it reminded me of a thought that I had during that part of the story.
What was that thought, you?
Well, I felt like the Russos were making a statement that you could take or leave after watching this, which was, I think they thought the war was pretty pointless given how they represented it on film here. It's not that saving human lives is pointless. I'm not saying that. It's more like he never really realized why he was there, what he was doing. That none of that was like communicated to us that he felt strongly about it. It was like, as soon as he got there, he was like, oh shit, I don't want to be here anymore. Everything we saw him do was like, they're just riding around. Oh shit, there's trouble over there. Then they go over there. Then, oh, everybody dies. And then it's like, there doesn't seem to be any big understanding about why any of that was happening.
I mean, I think you're right. Like the scene in the high school gym, like really sent that home. And he was like, I don't even want to be standing here. Like, I don't want this metal. I don't, you know, like, like this was all just crazy town. I mean, I could see that fully. I also think that it's a really good example. And really, again, like all of us, we were all so young making such big decisions that would affect the rest of our lives. I feel like I'm kind of like angry at the adults in the world. And I want to be like, y'all shouldn't, if we can't rent a car till we're 25, stop letting us get married and join up for the service and Seriously. Get mortgages. Like, if you understand that we can't handle a rental car and y'all know that, then shame on you for letting us make these huge choices that really we can't handle. For those of you out there who don't know, especially the male brain does not fully mature until 25. So these are like actually inconceivable decisions they are making.
You took advantage of me?
I did. I did.
I'm here today as your mediator. I've been called in under false pretense as a podcast host.
I was in the same boat, to be honest. Like, I took advantage of myself, or society took advantage of us, that we were young and willing and hard workers. And we're like, hey, come on over here, sign up for a credit card at 17. What a good idea, you know? And I was like, why did I do that? Right. I still have that credit card. Like, but just, we shouldn't be able to do that.
Right. There's so many things that they don't teach you in high school about life. Right. They're, you know, we're taught how to do like the most ridiculous things in high school, like square dancing was a big thing in my high school. And like, did I learn how to balance a checkbook? No. Did I learn how? I had to look up what escrow was when I was signing the contract for a mortgage. I'm like on my phone. Right. And I'm like, what is escrow?
Do-si-do-ing your way around the bank office.
Do-si-do did not factor in.
See, but I think do-si-do is more important than like the Pythagorean theorem, which I haven't used a day in my life. You know, come on. At least you could dance, Sheila.
Right. Forgotten all about the hypotenuse.
I don't even know what a hypotenuse is anymore.
I have no idea. But there's just so much that we just were not, you know, privy to, and you have to learn it through life experience. And this is where I'm coming back to with the role of Cherry. I didn't see like a parental unit you know, involved in his life. I don't know if he had a family support. Like, he didn't seem to have very many positive role models in his life, you know, sort of guiding him and maybe telling him that, you know, recruiting, you know, going to the Army recruiting office because of a heartbreak is probably not the best use of your time.
And what are we all like, given a huge eyebrow to the recruiting officer who's like, oh, you're having a heartache moment? Yeah. Oh, you're just who I want.
Right.
Nah, I have a cousin who was in the Army, and he had to do part of his career as a recruiter, and he hated it because the expectation was to constantly apply pressure to
show up at their house. Like, what a terrible, you know, it's the only adult authority figure we see
expected.
Having a conversation with him. Yeah, right. So I'm going to say systematically it's wrong. Institutionally, it's wrong to do that. I'm not saying that that man or those people who ever filled that role are bad people. But just the idea that I think that is the only authority figure. We never see a teacher. We never see a parent. It was good that they made him 23 because we didn't have to question, like, why is he not sleeping in his childhood bed? Like, we get it. Okay, he's 23. He's with his friends at this point. But it still seems like there was no one who saw him. And even once he was in the military, surrounded by authority figures, no one saw him.
Right. He was just another nameless face.
How did you guys think about that entire military sequence with the boot camp? I saw a couple of trivia pieces that said it was actually shot cinematically in the same sequence as Full Metal Jacket. Did that like hit home for you guys that this was familiar? Because I've definitely seen Full Metal Jacket.
Well, I think that ties into a larger comment that may be a little spoilery, but probably not, which was that this movie reminded me of several other movies or TV shows.
Okay.
And that aspect of it did remind me, and I didn't know that it was intentional, but it did remind me of Full Metal Jacket, even, you know, the setting and the sequence and the
man committing suicide in the bathroom.
I mean, the circumstances were different, but yeah, it doesn't, you know, same thing happened. Result.
What were some of the other ones that you saw?
Say the opening that I described earlier with the monologue where he describes himself as being separate from the world and seeing things in a way that he didn't think other people saw things. It reminded me of like Dexter. Dexter does the same thing where he's explaining how he's either a sociopath or a psychopath, but he's very well trained into being able to fake that he's a normal person because he understands the expectations of that, but he also knows that he has this release valve that he needs to let loose on people that he considers deserving of his wrath.
But he also doesn't think that he's a bad person either.
Right. So there's that aspect of it that also kind of reminded me of Goodfellas, particularly the aspect of like breaking the fourth wall, continuing to address the audience, and the long section of drug abuse resembled, I thought, Henry's interaction with drugs. And
wasn't there in particular line? It's like, I'd always want to be a gangster. Is that when you were like pointing at me?
that was a different show. But after boot camp, doesn't he say no one should join the Army or something like that? Similar kind of feeling.
Yeah.
After he said that, I was questioning, I bet they did not get the Army's assistance with this.
Yeah.
Like those Humvees and those helicopters and all that can all be faked. It's usually when you get like jets and shit like that you really need the Army's assistance.
Yeah.
Right. Did you get like a Forrest Gump vibe at any point there in all these montage kind of parts?
Yeah, I guess you could say there was a Forrest Gump because it was like it was helping with the storytelling. The narration was bridging some of these gaps. So, yeah, you could say that you were getting a bit of a Forrest Gump vibe.
Or the vagabond nature of his life, you know, going from like one thing to the next, kind of like Forrest did.
I felt like the scenes actually within the boot camp part of like getting yelled at. And,
oh, absolutely. There. Yeah.
I mean, there was a total feel there. There was something else, and it's killing me right now that I can't think of it, that I got that feeling of that part where he goes, I just decided I wanted to go for a run. I just started running that part. And he just goes, there was a part in this where he says something similar to that. And I actually thought he was going to start writing. And I was like, what is this? And I forgive me for not being able to give a specific, but how about this? If you haven't seen it, look out for a part where you feel like he might start a marathon run, because there was something about it where he's kind of snapped a little bit and he's just like, you think he could do just about anything, including it wouldn't have been crazy to have a montage marathon run across the nation. It could have happened.
Inspirational run across the nation. Yeah.
You guys, I want to ask you, because, you know, representation is so important. And I really like kind of keyed in on, there was a person of color soldier who was getting particularly screamed at. I don't know if you guys noticed this or didn't. There was like the one scene where there was like five drill sergeants around him, mm-hmm. and they were screaming at him. And then later he was like the one that was kind of a little further back. He was getting screamed at. Were we supposed to get any message out of that? Or did it just happen to be that guy? Like in Full Metal Jacket, there was, you know, the heavier set guy. Like it's just, there's always going to kind of be that guy.
Like the oddball out.
Yeah.
Many of the drill sergeants who were doing the yelling too were also people of color. So,
right.
Or men. Right. So I don't know if that was.
We had a conversation about this and it wasn't about this show. What one was it where I actually stopped to look up what the diversity demographics were for the military? Oh, it was Avatar. Because I started looking up because I was like, I feel like this is not right. And this wasn't right either necessarily, but Avatar certainly wasn't right either. They just had a wrong mix of ethnicities for the actual military. I don't know why mm-hmm. it struck us so much, but it did. We kind of stepped back and were like, is this right? I don't.
Well, I think this is, I'll say this is crass, knowing that it's crass. Mm. I think that the representation in the Avatar's, you know, Pandoran security force was, you know, it had Stephen Lang, a very white guy in charge, and then a lot of people of color manning the guns. And you wanted to see, is that?
I don't know why it struck close? Me. I think because I thought there was a dynamic there of sort of like this loud white man screaming at everybody. And of course, there was blue people, too, in that movie. So, I mean, let's be real. There was different.
We embrace all colors over here.
Yeah, there was different ethnicities going on there, or cultures going on there, too. So I feel like I was just curious if there was something going on there, if we were supposed to pick up something, because it is 2021. And I don't think that you can totally be like, it just happened to be, but maybe it did just happen to be. I don't know. I don't have any experience with this. So if it didn't hit on y'all, if it didn't make you think like, huh, why isn't that particularly that guy?
Well,
it was a heavyset guy.
But in making the representation correct, I mean, having someone of color being a drill instructor is true. My one of my brother's drill instructors who we met was a man of color. And he is still to this day in my 42 years on this earth, the most foreboding man I've ever encountered in my entire life. just because he was a walking wall and I knew that he could snap my neck seven ways to Sunday. but then also having the privates, the enlistees, being a mix of color that is truly representative of the Army. I appreciate that. If he'd been just yelling at another white kid, I've been like, okay, thank you, Full Metal Jacket, for, you know, just resurfacing the way that you just did here 35 years later. So I didn't notice it until you started talking about it. But I was like, you know what? If that had been a white kid, I would have been like, no, that's not real.
Intrigue. Okay. And I'm just, I guess I'll just go with like, you know, still being a heavyset person in the military is a minority. And, you know, in this case, that man was a minority in the group. So maybe I'm just going to even use that as like a same.
Or it might be nothing.
Or it could be nothing at all. We could even cut this part out. I don't even care. I'm just saying. It was just something that I noticed and I didn't know, you know, if you're going to go through all these moments, I just felt like there was a looking in the background, playing that game of like looking in the background of what's going on behind the main character. What am I supposed to be seeing or picking up on, you know? And Russo brothers are known for this. So I'm like peeping back there and I'm like, why is it always this one kid? Why is it always this one guy? What's going on? And maybe that is just, again, that feeling that he managed to kind of blend in here, representing one guy who just takes all the shit, it seems, especially within boot camp, would be an accurate portrayal of like what probably does happen.
I know that we haven't delivered our love it or leave it yet, but I think the Russos can be credited with making very intentional movies. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. things are not in them. They don't tell the extras, go mill around over
right.
there.
Right. So know? it's making me think.
And then also, was this guy the shadowed person committing suicide in the hallway, yeah. in the bathroom?
Don't you guys right? think it has to be? Because if we're following the Full Metal Jacket kind of storyline, doesn't it have to be?
Mm. Yeah, it really does.
So then I'm like, okay. So I see. So that sort of was happening in the background, which is maybe simply fulfilling the Full Metal Jacket storyline in the background. You know, you got this one guy being picked on, but we're not going to pay attention to him because it's not his story.
Right. That's the equivalent of Community, like, you know, delivering the baby in the background. Like this, mm-hmm. this kid's getting yelled at and he's also in a different, you know, realm than the rest of them because he is a little more heavy set than the typical Army enlistee. And right. then, you know, he's the one potentially committing suicide. It made sense that he's the only one who could have been that person. But he's only in shadow. We don't see him.
His enlistment is a 2-year hitch, but they only show us, I think, the part that we are having the movie named after,
yeah.
the cherry breaking, as it were. Mm-hmm. And this is the part that he goes from having any idealism left in him from the young man that joined the army to the broken man that comes home, and the scenes that led up to that. Really, I can't necessarily fault the character or the real man for having undergone a major change given what he went through. Someone that would go through those scenes and not come out impacted is robotic or something.
Yeah.
They feel things differently. And that's part of the wondering what went into that opening monologue again that I mentioned, where he says that he sees and feels things differently when, I don't know, this scene, he feels it like everyone else I know would have felt.
Well, maybe it's after the fact, though, he sees and feels things differently.
The monologue is delivered chronologically mm-hmm. after he goes through all this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know, the way he presented it, it sounded like he'd felt this way his whole life. You know, was feeling trees are special and, you know, all that stuff. Again, it's just that moment, it did change him, but it would have changed almost anybody.
I don't know who it wouldn't have changed. I mean, Sheila, you said you have some experience with soldiers and PTSD and that type of thing. So, I mean, I am assuming that everyone comes back with some level of PTSD.
There is not one person I know who's gone over to Iraq or Afghanistan that's in my world, my wheelhouse, that did not come back with some level of emotional damage from what they had to do, from what orders they had to follow, from what they had to see and endure. And they were all in their like early 20s where and ahead of the time where that male brain, Caroline, to your point, is fully matured. So now you have emotional damage on top of still a developing brain being asked to do some really horrific things. Paul, you touched on it earlier, too. And it's like, and what was it for? You know, what was the origin, right? So it's like, you know, we've damaged potentially a generation of adults. And do we really get the reward for it?
There's so many little parts to the actual Iraq part that you could see breaking him. You know, little small moments like the MRE portion to, of course, the huge moments, you know, right. where there was actual loss. There's so
personal
much
personal loss,
there.
Right?
Personal yeah. loss, yeah. And then he realizing that as a medic, you don't have like magic hands. You know, you can't fix everything. And how awful that must feel that to have put that responsibility on your shoulders and not been able to deliver. I can't imagine thinking, well, I'm going to take the job within the military where I'm a helper. I don't want to shoot anybody. I don't want to ever be in that position. But I'm going to be on the side that helps. I could have been kind of like him, where like it never would have dawned on me that there would be anyone I couldn't fix. And then it was like my hands
guilt.
Was on them. Yeah. Right. And that my hands were on them and it didn't work out.
It didn't work. Exactly. That's survivor's uh-huh. guilt. And it doesn't matter if you're a medic or if you're on the ground, if you're in a Humvee, if you're in the air, like everyone has that moment where they survived something that somebody they knew didn't. And, you know, 20 years later, it's still haunting them.
I guess that explains that one scene where they are helping the locals, but it turns out unless you have like a scratch that can be bandaged, then there's really nothing they can do.
And that huge realization that it's like lip service, like, well, we're here and we're causing all this damage to the locals. And yeah, we're going to help you out. But like in reality, it's just like, you know, pushing
it's just
them through
prolonging being, the inevitable.
Yeah. And just telling, well, you need to go to a hospital. And, you know, the interpreter being like, we're not going to the hospital, dude. Like, right. What are you talking about? Like, and anyway, y'all's, you know, skirmish here was like part of the problem. So you need to help out. Lacking simple things like antibiotics also kind of scared the crap out of me for some reason. Right. That I was like, oh my gosh, that's just like a basic thing. And again, if I was volunteered to be a medic, I would assume I would be given the proper supplies to do my job. And so the idea that, no, you're going to have to see people, and then the most basic of supplies you can't provide, and it's on your neck that you know that older man is now most likely going to die.
Right. Like, it's a death sentence, essentially.
I don't think my heart can handle it. And yet I would have chosen that job. I know I would have, so that I wouldn't have ever had to shoot a gun, you know, and I would have been like, no, this is worse, I think.
Yeah, it is worse. I agree.
That is harsh. Were you guys ready to get into the next part of the movie?
Sure.
Sure.
What's interesting about the drug addiction, at least for me, was that wasn't like, you know, like in a lot of Vietnam era movies, there was some element of, say, morphine, coming in contact with morphine and then coming home and needing to find something like that, you know, or coming into contact with heroin or something like that because they just found it over there and then coming back and needing more of it.
Right. Well, it's available, right? You know,
right
over there.
But then
that's where they grow it.
This seemed more like throwaway, like almost optional, like he just came in contact with oxy, right?
Well, taking it though, because of a variety of pain that he was feeling across the board, I'm going to say mental and physical and emotional and everything going on. I mean, I think he was trying to block that out. They did a great job of things like the night terrors. Again, we've had personal experience with people hurting other people while they're sleeping because they didn't realize what was happening. And so things like that happening, that I think that was super realistic and frightening. You know, you could see where you'd want that to stop. And if you could medically make it stop, you would.
I mean, optional in the sense of that didn't seem like the only route that could have gone. It wasn't like that was the best treatment option. It was just like carelessly introduced into his life.
That's a really good call, though. And I think, again, like Sheila, I think that you could probably speak to this idea, though, too, of how often things like that can be done so carelessly. You know, if a doctor or if the medical system, whomever you are like dealing with, doesn't realize all the sort of buildup to you being there, there's a fair shot that it could be lost on someone that this is actually a terrible choice to prescribe this to the person.
Right. I mean, like Dr. Whomever, he's missing a lot of the red flags. He's not asking the questions.
Fucking Dr. Whoever. Yeah.
I mean, they went to lengths. I mean, it was embroidered on his coat and it wasn't just on his name tag.
That's,
I mean,
really
like,
funny.
They went deep with that there. But, you know, he just, for the time too, like oxy was the prescribing agent of choice because it did its job really well. Like, you're in pain, let's dull it. Xanax isn't working. Okay, well, the next thing up is oxy. And, you know, in hindsight, was it smart? No. But yeah, it's just that. But even for, like, my husband had surgery like earlier in March, and they didn't prescribe him anything stronger than like basically Advil. Like, leaving the hospital, he had 3 discs in his neck replaced.
No.
And
way. Oh,
yeah.
No.
And I was like, they gave me some good stuff. He goes, no, not really.
Right. They gave me this bit of leather to bite.
Yeah, no, basically, no. You know, some whiskey and a chomping bit, you know.
I'm glad that we're really focusing in on that Dr. Whomever part, because that to me, again, describes the system-wide problem, that it's not like this was one isolated case where on accident one doctor who was careless gave out this medication. No, this was,
you know, this guy didn't slip through the cracks at all. This was systemic.
Yeah. And this is what soldiers are given all the time still. So there's still a lot of concern about this.
That's if they can get an appointment at the VA, right? You know, that's the other thing that they didn't talk about here. And if there had been good mental health, if there had been good infrastructure around these men and women coming back from war, that we would be in a different spot now. Like, it's almost like we didn't learn any lessons from Vietnam. And I think that this movie does a good job in highlighting that, that we didn't learn any good lessons that we applied here, because we're still enduring mental illness with our vets. We're still enduring basic health crises with our vets, that the VA is just not able to catch everyone, and people fall through the cracks and people become addicted and they become homeless. They have a lot of issues societally that we could be dealing with in a different way. So I feel like that's where this movie kind of like hits home hard.
it does a really great job being realistic in those terms. It's painful, I would say, how many things that are so common in our like human history. We've always had warriors or soldiers or whatever. And every story, I swear to God, I don't care how far back you go, the warrior comes back and they're having a hard time readjusting, you know? I think about this like throughout the whole thing and how easy it would be to know, okay, obviously they are going to be set up and ready to be taken advantage of things like psychedelic drugs and things like that. Like they're like primed to need it practically, you know?
Right.
It's wild to me. I think about that in things like childbirth and stuff too, where I'm like, why can't we do this better? Like people have been doing this since the beginning of time.
Seriously.
Why is it like a shock that the mother has like a flood of hormones afterwards and needs mental health care as well as physical care? Like why right. does this get forgotten? It's fascinating the things that we learn and the things that we say science, and then the things that we're like, and we act like none of that exists.
Yeah. And then we get shocked at the outcomes when these people spiral without the help that they need and the support that they need.
Well, and really important, we isolate those cases and say, oh, well, that was just John's problem. That was just Mary's issue. No, no, no. This is soldier. This is, you know, we're going to go generic. This is a whole issue for a whole
bunch
of people.
Let's use that word again, systemic. It's
very much.
There is a society of people. There is a class of people who need support at different times, be it new moms, be it returning soldiers. And society shouldn't fall down and, you know, act surprised like, oh my God, this war veteran robbed six banks over 4 months. No. Well, let's look at what happened to this poor kid, you know, when he came back, right? Like, instead of looking at the details of what also contributed to this.
So, Paul, bank robberies, pro or con?
I mean, it's probably not a life choice for me.
No.
Why?
I thought he was the kindest bank robber I'd ever seen in my life.
Well, he did escalate, you know, from just simply,
as one does,
simply saying, you know, I've got a gun. Mm-hmm. Then he flashed the gun, and then he pointed the gun. But it wasn't all in one go, and it was sort of as the seriousness of his dependency on pills and coke and black. Also elevated that he needed to get more definitely in the teller's face with what he was doing. But that was always going to be a losing deal because they kept needing more heroin on the deal. So as long as they kept needing drugs, they were never going to get ahead of it. They were never going to. And that was the idea with robbing the banks, was to get square with a debt.
Yeah.
But they kept putting themselves into debt.
So we need to back up just a little bit and get back to our casting question at the beginning, because we're ignoring a huge thread throughout this entire movie, which is, of course, the love story between our main character and Emily. We had talked a little bit about Sierra Bravo, just a teeny bit at the beginning. But Paul, I know you know her from something else.
Yeah, well, I just looked at her credits and she has acted a very, very long time. I don't know her from the Red Band Society. I don't know her from Big Time Rush, but she had long-running roles in both of those shows. But what I know her from is Wayne.
Which, did you ever see Wayne?
I did not.
You gotta watch it, Sheila. You gotta watch it. I did not think I was gonna like it because there's something about it that's kind of simple in a funny way to say that. But it's like there's not this. It's a very small story. Okay, Wayne is young. And the story is not, it's like kind of hanging out with kids in the backyard-ish, you know, but of course, exaggerated beyond belief. So there's like insane fight scenes and stuff like that where you're like, what the heck? Yeah. You know, like that was punching like you'd see on like Rocky, like, but these are like kids.
Wayne is this kid with a very intense sense of right and wrong, kind of a black and white sense of right and wrong. And then he believes himself to be the arbiter and the executioner if need be. He doesn't kill people. No, I'm not saying like that. It's more like judge and executioner. I mean that he will carry out his sentence to get square with right and wrong, to reset the balance.
He's not wickedly unlike Cherry here. He's just much, 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 much younger. So it's a much smaller scale.
And the thing is, though, he's willing to get into a fight, but what makes the show watchable is that he does not always win.
the fights are crazy.
Yeah. And Sierra Bravo is his Wayne's love interest.
And fully his motivation, not unlike Cherry. Like, the things that he's doing is always because he feels someone's wronged Del, and he's got to make a scene out of it, you know? So for sure, I think there's a lot there that is similar to this in a funny little, tiny little microcosm way.
She puts on this really thick South Boston accent that is integral to her character.
I think you'd enjoy it, Sheila. You gotta check it out.
You know, Mayhem from the insurance commercials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wayne bites off that guy's nose.
When I say intense, I mean intense. Like, it takes this stuff to like another level. Where you're like, oh my god, these are just kids, and then you're like, no, look what Wayne just did. It's wild. It's wild. But Sierra Bravo, she is a character that for me forever has played this tiny little baby-faced little girl. And at first, I gotta tell you, because the beginning part of her was as more of this first just sweet love interest, but when we got into the sexuality part of it, like when she was laying on the bed, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, she's too young, this is hurting my eyes, like I can't see this, you know? But then I did transform my opinion over time, because I felt like her body type fit the drug addiction portion the way that it needed to, you know, like right. She sold it with
like the heroin yeah, skinny.
Yeah. I mean, she, and you can't fake that, you know, like you have to look like that. Even Tom himself actually gained and lost 30 pounds during the 4 months in order to show this.
I watched like just a brief little snippet. They said that he lost a quarter of his body weight. I'm like, that's a lot of weight.
Yeah. But when you look at it, how healthy he looks in some scenes,
right.
And I'm going to say healthy, but, and then how emaciated he looks, she doesn't have that huge span.
Transformation, yeah.
But gosh, you guys, the symbolism and the little symbol of her ribbon tied around her neck as like this cute little innocent. And Paul was like, was that like a thing? And I'm like, well, choker necklaces were totally a thing, and like little ribbons.
This is just like a bow, like a little bow tie.
It was a necklace. It was like,
it was meant to be her necklace. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then to use that same ribbon later to tie off her arm for the drugs.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah, the symbolism of like virginity and sweetness and innocence. And now be like, and now we've got into Pulp Fiction.
And it's actually going to facilitate her drug use.
Right.
Oh my God.
Like, and he even talks about her necklace and, you know, he talks about it and it's just like, yep, there it is.
Well, it was so much. Oh my God.
Let's just not talk about that.
So Sierra Bravo being cast as Emily, did it work for you, Sheila? Was she the right age, the right look for the film?
I only saw her briefly in A Teacher, you know, that series on Hulu a couple months back. So I really didn't have much exposure to her. And I just thought that she was just like this sweet, adorable, perfect first love interest. And,
very,
you know,
Winnie Cooper, no? Didn't you
yes.
get that vibe?
Oh, my God. Yes. Super, absolutely. Yeah. Like reincarnated. And I thought for sure she was going to bolt when things started to get tough. I did not foresee her marrying him. And I did not foresee all of the I thought like more from what I've seen in the trailer, like his spiral was because she was just like, dude, I'm going to cut and run, like that. This was not the life for her. So the fact that she stuck with him for the journey, you know, was kind of admirable, I guess. But no, I really liked her. And I find her very intriguing. Like I didn't give her much credence in the beginning, and because I wasn't really becoming invested in her, because I was like, oh, you're gonna cut and run, sweetheart. But when she started like sticking around, I was like, oh, you're more interesting than I thought you were. So I like the depth that Kiara Bravo brought to this. Is it Kiara or Ciara?
I looked it up. It said Ciara, but you guys.
I think that depends on the pronunciation.
I agree with you. But I like looked it up, and like the little pronunciation guide said Ciara, but well, I was like, I was worried too. Is this,
you know,
like
when army guys are like spelling things out, they go Alpha Bravo. Well, Sierra,
Sierra,
but is with an S though. It's not for the S.
Right. So like in my
Charlie.
Yeah. So like in my family, I have a cousin, and her name is Kira. It's spelled the same exact way, but it's pronounced Kira. And I've heard Kiara. I've heard a bunch of different things.
My sister has a friend named Sierra, spelled the same way.
Yeah, but, so yeah. I'm not sure. So if we are mispronouncing her name, I apologize.
Okay, here's my little example.
Sierra Bravo.
This is where I got it from. So the Google says you pronounce it Sierra Bravo. So I don't know if it's totally wrong, but if it's not, you guys blame Google. Don't blame us.
That's right.
Apologies all around. For Ms. Bravo, we'll call her for the rest of the time.
Yes, there you go. Done.
I'm looking through the casting here, and I didn't realize Cousin Joe looked familiar.
Michael Rispoli, right?
No,
Cousin Joe, no.
Cousin Joe is James Gandolfini's kid.
Yes.
He's the lead in the upcoming Sopranos prequel series on HBO.
Wow, that's going to be a great show.
Yeah.
I was getting weird vibes off of him. I was like, who are you? So I had to go to IMDb. Not weird vibes in a bad way, but I've seen you before. Like, but no, it was his dad. It was like that. It was
channeling. Punch you in the dick?
Oh my gosh. Well, did you guys realize that there was a cameo in this one that Tom Holland's brother, Harry, plays one of the drug dealers, and he's going to reprise that role. Paul's going to love this. In Marvel's Spider-Man No Way Home.
I did not know
that. He's going to be like the same drug dealer in that movie.
Oh, wow.
I know, people. What?
And Joe Russo was one of the, he was the owner of the bar that Cherry worked at.
Joe
was in Endgame as one of the support group people.
Okay.
In Captain America's support group.
Mm-hmm.
He does show up in his own work from time to time.
Paul, did you recognize old Miss Bravo from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? I know you're a big fan of that one.
You know, I didn't. A lot of episodes there, so no, I didn't remember that character.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah.
Too bad.
And there was a Wahlberg.
Which Wahlberg did you spy?
He plays Jimenez over in Iraq, Jeff Wahlberg. He's Donnie and Mark's nephew.
Oh.
Yeah.
Look at that. It's a little bit of a distance there, but I'm for it. I'm for it.
He played Diego in the Dora movie.
Oh, Diego. That's how Elizabeth says it, our middle kid. She goes, Diego.
That is adorable.
Too funny.
So we have some deep cameos here, deep supporting roles.
Yeah, there were. And one of the things about this film is that it feels so difficult to get through as a viewer because of the realism to me. The drug scenes were long, guys, and the desperation was real. Trying to get that money felt realistic. Like, there was no part of me that I was like, oh gosh, they could just get it some other way or blah, blah, blah. Or they could simply stop. The bus scene, when he's like, get back on the bus. And she's like, I'm going to get high with or without you. I watched an interview with the Russo brothers, and the interviewee happened to have a roommate who was on heroin. And he's like, we've had those exact moments. We've had him in the hospital getting high in the bathroom after he's overdosed. We've had him, doing all these different things. And he was like, I know it seems insane and it seems exaggerated in the movie, but it's not. Like, this is the level of desperation.
I've had to sit with friends, like a friend of mine who he got out of rehab like 4 o'clock on a Monday, and he got out of the hospital rehab 4 o'clock on a Monday, wasn't going into inpatient rehab till 7 a.m. on Tuesday. Wow. And I sat with him all night.
You'd have to get him on him like a backpack, huh? Be like, if you go somewhere, you're taking me with.
Well, I just sat in his house with him so that this way, he's like, I want to do this. I'm committed. I'm like, yes, but if you're left alone, you might just do like one final like bender,
Right.
And thankfully, it wasn't heroin, but it was equally as addictive alcohol.
I just watched a Blossom where the oldest brother, Anthony, on his 2-year sobriety, decides to drink an entire bottle of vodka right there in the living room, right out of the bottle.
That is some bad life choices.
Yeah. And it was just a 2-year thing. He just did it. And then he got right back on the wagon. But go figure. This was intense. I read a little thing too, that the black and white scenes that we see, which they're kind of sprinkled out throughout. Mm-hmm. It was actually supposed to be reminiscent of Natural Born Killers. Were you getting any of that? Were you feeling any of that?
Not that I could name the movie directly, but I was intrigued by the intentionality of it. And then I guess with the bank robbery and how it was escalating, that definitely makes a parallel to me for Natural Born Killers.
Mm, I like that.
Now that you bring that up, very good.
So that's, I think, the big issue for me with this movie. I mean, it's we've been talking about how these different aspects of the movie have a good, rooted in real life kind of meaning. But at the end of the day, we signed up to watch a movie.
Would it have helped you if it said at the beginning, Cherry, an autobiographical story?
Nope. How this movie reminded us in different ways of other movies, like I mentioned, Goodfellas, like with the drug half of this movie, I felt like that made its point earlier than it let up the gas.
Right.
And so as a movie, different parts of this felt long or overdone, or I get it. I get it. I get it.
See, but that's where I could push back. I could push back and say, yeah, but you guys, if being a soldier and being in the desert and being a medic is uncomfortable and upsetting, and those times felt that way, being a drug addict, it seems like every day blurs into the next and there would never be an end to this. And you're right. As an observer, as Sheila sitting with her friend at night, you're like, let this be done. Let this night end, you know, let this portion of the movie be over. But it isn't for so much longer than you're prepared to sit there and deal with it.
But I'm watching a Russo brother movie with Spider-Man. I'm, you know,
right. Which,
I don't
which...
need him to be Spider-Man, but I do need it. I don't know. When I'm watching a Scorsese movie or something like that, I expect that sort of.
Well, so are you kind of painting the Russo's brothers like in a little box here, where it's like y'all don't get to be Scorsese. You got to be.
I mean, I literally just finished The Irishman before I started watching this. I started watching it last year.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
No, I'm kidding.
That's funny.
No, but I mean, like, so for me, like, the war part was not overdone. Like, I didn't feel like that ran long. Like, I feel like you needed that in order to understand how broken he became. The aftermath, for me, did run long. Like, the drug scenes, they didn't feel gratuitous, but it did feel like they could have probably buttoned it up just a
little
bit.
One cycle there of, okay, now we're totally strung out. Now we need more money. Now we're robbing another bank.
Right. I think the part with the safe and, you know.
Oh, my God, you guys.
Something could have been combined.
Oh, yeah, it could have been truncated a little bit because, like, again.
A montage action?
Yeah.
Do it, Paul.
Montage.
We gotta have a montage.
Yeah, because like that's the part for me that I was just like, okay, where is this going?
So you guys, we are going to start talking about the ending of the film. So if you guys have not seen it and you'd like to watch it, please turn it off now. We're getting into a spoiler section. Before that, we are going to give you our love it or leave it recommendations at this point. And I'm going to start with Sheila.
Like I said, this was a hard watch for me. It was very much rooted in realism, and you know, the lack of identity makes this like kind of like an every person story. Like everybody has a moment here that they can relate to. For me, it doesn't really kind of matter what your age is. You have that moment of despair, or you have that moment of, you know, the war moments that we can relate to. So I think it's definitely worth watching. I'm not going to say that I love it because it is a very hard watch, but it was worth my time to watch it. So let's put it that way. It's 142 minutes of my time that I'm like, okay, that was worth it.
Oh, so in a love it or leave it, you give a worth it?
I'm looking at, well.
We might have to call it like a love it or worth it or leave it.
Well, okay.
Or run from it.
I mean, like, we spent like the better part of like over an hour here talking about it. So I guess you could say that I do love it, but it's just, it's like, I'm going to caveat it by saying it's real, it's gritty, it's hard to watch. There are moments that you can relate to, good and bad. And a lot of the bad, you know, it's really the bad depths of the human soul. And that makes it like really kind of hard to watch. But I think everybody, you know, who's a fan of movie watching should watch this movie for sure. So I'm going to say I love it. Okay. Retracting my earlier worth
it. Retracting your worth it.
I'm retracting my worth it. Because like, you know, we have talked about it and there have been, you know, really good points that we talked about. Does it know if it's a satire? Does it know that if it's a drama? Maybe not, but does it really matter? Because it's both.
Maybe life is that a little dramedy. Right.
Yeah. Like there's never
moments of absurdity within. Moments
right. Like
of tragedy.
The robot, like him doing the robot. Yeah. And, you know, then he becomes a robot. Right. He becomes this very mechanical kind of a person. So, you know, we're too often drawn into like making a decision about a movie because it's not one thing or another. So, yeah, it's a comedy. Yeah, it's a satire. Yeah, it's a drama. So it's all of those things, because like you said, Caroline, it's what life is. And it's a nasty, gritty war story. And then when I learned that it was autobiographical, I'm like, that makes it actually so much worse, because this didn't come out of someone's imagination. This kind of came out of someone's life.
Right. Paul, what do you think? Love it or leave it?
I think I fall on the other side. It's not that I think it's not worthwhile.
Thank you for supporting my worth it.
Yeah. I think that not being able to settle on a tone, or keeping up with, are we breaking the fourth wall? Are we not? How we're telling the story? How is this character, this other feeling person, forever or I don't know. I just didn't connect with some of the stuff that became integral to the setup of the movie. And overall, I was ready to be done earlier than the movie was ready to be done. All those things add up to I don't know who I'm going to recommend this to, so I have to leave it.
For my own self, I was surprised to find out that they had actually cut 9 minutes out of this movie, because I agree with you that it feels like it runs long. At the same time, I understand movies where they feel like they've got to put you through it in order for you to feel what the main character went through. And there's no part of me that didn't feel exhausted, desperate, tired, you know, just generally by the end. You know, I felt like, oh my God, you know, how much longer is he going to have to go through this? How much longer am I going to go through this? And so it's a little messy there, because I would say love it from the standpoint of, you need to know what you're going into. You need to understand that this could absolutely be triggering for you, that this could be difficult for you. I think the way that it was set up in parts was intentional to give you a break. Too, if you needed to walk away like Sheila did or whatever, you could do that and know that a new part was starting. You know, I think it was very definitive about that. I don't have the same experience with Tom Holland in terms of being like totally in love with him as Spider-Man. So for me, while I've seen the movies, it's not like, oh gosh, this is Spider-Man doing this like outrageous stuff. So I think that the casting worked for me. The visual shots, I think, were interesting and kept me invested. I was peeping around in the background to see Dr. Whomever. And when I found those little things, I was like gleeful. Like I was like, oh my gosh, look, it says this in the background or shitty bank or whatever. Like it was like a reward for me, I guess, of hanging in there when things were kind of getting difficult to sit through. So maybe those were little breaths of fresh air, perhaps, during a pretty heavy movie. So overall, I'll give it a love it, but I am adding my little asterisk of, please be certain that you know what this movie's about before you sit down, and be willing to walk away and take a breather if you need it and come back, because this could be one that feels very real. And I think they did themselves actually a little disservice by not saying that this was autobiographical louder and bigger.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think there should have been a one-liner at the beginning or at the end or something.
Like Cherry, colon, an autobiographical story.
Something. Or, you know, how many times have we been in a movie theater where there's just the one-line sentence at the end that says, like, this the story was based on, true events. Yeah, I think it shifts, because I think there's a lot of things all three of us would have criticized had we not realized this really happened. Who would have said, that's outlandish, that would never happen, who would ever do that, why'd they choose that? But once you know it really happened, you're like, well, I got a different viewpoint on this whole thing now.
I don't want to imply that my leave it is based on shitty movie making or something like that. I just looked up the cinematographer, who they list as the director of photography, which is more or less the same thing. And let me just list off what he's known for. And you'll be like, oh, my God. He made Drive with Ryan Gosling, Three Kings with David O. Russell. The Usual Suspects with Bryan Singer, and X-Men Apocalypse is not really a well-regarded movie, but another well-known movie anyway with Bryan Singer. So he doesn't make rom-com kind of standard, generic, everyone has seen it before kind of movies. He makes, like, Drive in particular is very well known for being super specific to, like, coloration and lighting and scenes being so deliberately shot that they mean something in the way that they're composed.
Paul, you just said something really interesting about the cinematography. Like Emily, anytime in the early part, so in the first half, in the little vignettes, she's bathed in sunlight.
Mm.
In the classroom, she's the only one that sort of the sun is shining on in when they're in bed together the first time, like the sun, like she leans back and she's in bathed in the sunlight. So that's a really interesting take and something that I was like, oh, I said that has to be intentional. So when you said about like how the cinematographer frames the shots, that struck me.
And then during the drugged out scenes, she's almost always inside or in shadow
or in blue.
And then
like a blue light.
The very last scene where we see her, she is framed by sunlight. I think we're going to wait until the actual spoilery section before we say things. But that very last time that we see her, it's like sunrise, I think. One final note on the cinematographer. I mentioned that he didn't do like rom-coms, which is true.
Oh, you did. I heard that.
But he also did a few Wonder Years episodes. So to get back to he shot the pilot.
That's funny.
actually. So, yeah.
That's so funny.
And while we're just talking about creds, the Russo brothers also, believe it or not, they were executive producers on the show Happy Endings, I love. And they also directed the pilot, which I thought was hilarious.
I agree. I completely agree. It's a great show. Okay, guys, so this is your last chance. If you do not want to know what happens at the end of this film, please turn this off now. Okay, folks, so check it out. I want to tell you this. Did you guys realize this little tiny little nugget when Cherry lays down and takes his last hit of heroin before the cops arrive? He's under a tree with bright yellow leaves, and the color yellow has also always been used to show support for the troops, and that was apparently intentional.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that, but I do know that, you know, the yellow ribbon. Yes. Connotation, but always. That's really cool.
I know. So you guys, let's talk about this. Did you guys see this coming? Did you see him giving up? Did you think he was going to commit suicide right there? Did you think he was going to overdose? What did you think?
I thought he was going to overdose. I thought that was it. I did not see a prison sentence. Like when he basically gave himself up and allowed himself to be trapped, I thought he was just going to overdose and that would be the end of this tragic story. I did not see the sort of light at the end of the tunnel, if you will.
For a minute, I thought that we were seeing the end of his life, you know, at the bank, because, you know, he was backing up and telling us the story of how he got to that point. But then I thought it would be much more logical that if he's telling us the story, then he survived, obviously. But I always hate when stories are told by the dead person.
The dead narrator.
Right. I think that's dumb. And so I gave them more credit for them doing that. I didn't think he was going to overdose, though. All I predicted was that he was going to survive the bank robbery, but I didn't go further than that when I was watching it in the moment.
I really was worried when he had the gun and he shoots it in the air. I don't know why I would think that he would actually shoot himself, because that wasn't where the trail was leading. I mean, certainly overdose, when his eyes rolled back, I thought, oh, he did it. You know, this was the end. He gave himself like a full, huge dose. Doing it in his foot and everything.
Yeah.
I was like, that gives me the heebie-jeebs. Yeah. Also, when he took his socks and shoes off, it gave me a flashback to Pills and Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And them taking his socks and shoes off. And so for some reason, I felt like, again, like that he was going to die. Like it was like the sign. And so I was like, oh no, he's like going to be barefoot thing there. So I did not see this entire back half of let's watch him like rehabilitate in prison.
Mm.
What was y'all's thoughts on that? Was it good? Was it interesting? Again, it's an autobiographical story. So what are you gonna say? Like, not interesting guy. You know, you can't really be like that. But did you feel like we needed this part of the story?
I feel like it was a way for us to see that somebody who can spiral to those depths can rebound, can come back and make something better, have a future, really. So I feel like it was a really important part to redeem society. Like, you fucked me over to this point and I still came out of this on the green side, you know, like on the good side. I'm happy that he went there. It was interesting to try to see Tom Holland age 15 years or so.
Right.
With the porn star mustache.
Means older.
Yeah, right. But I'm glad that we got to see that. And then also knowing that it's autobiographical for me now gives it much more meaning.
The prison part and letting himself get caught, I don't know how it went down in real life. I haven't read the book. Character-wise, I mean, it's a cool way to achieve some amount of redemption. Not that prison in and of itself is redeeming, but it's like he took himself out of the equation that was ruining Emily's life. And she stood a chance, he thought, if he wasn't constantly there with like supplying the drugs and enabling the drugs with the bank robberies and all that kind of stuff. So that part of it was cool from like a storytelling aspect. Staying in, what was it, 14 years he was in?
Yeah, in the book he was, it looks like 11 years in prison.
Okay.
So we were talking about it though, that it spanned essentially like 20 years that we were like watching here, I guess, like roughly.
Oh, right, from college till.
Yeah, which was fairly amazing because again, he like catches up with us like time-wise, age-wise. So right. To see him coming out, you know, with his motorcycle mustache, that's all I could think of. You guys, I teased so much when it was the very, very, very end. And I looked over at Paul and first of all, I was like, do you think there really is a guard at the end who like shakes your hand and tells you like, do a good job, happy life?
I don't think so.
I mean, I want to think so.
I was thinking, dude, would I want that job? I should apply for that job to be like the handshaker.
I'd be great at that job.
Me too. I'd be like, you did it. But
you got this. I don't ever want to see you back here, okay?
Exactly. Be like, yeah. let this be our last meeting, but big
let
high fives.
Let this be a lesson. Right.
Like, totally. But
bring
I
it in. Bring it in. Group hug.
I was like, if Brad Pitt is not in the parking lot waiting for him for their next Ocean's 11 heist, right. I'm be super bummed.
Eating a chili dog or whatever it was. Yeah.
Eating something at every scene.
I would have accepted Julia Roberts as well. Either one.
Yeah.
But I was pretty shocked to see Emily. Were y'all?
Yes.
Yes.
Didn't we all think she was probably dead?
I assumed that she was in the gutter somewhere, yeah.
I assumed that her parents swooped in and were like, you know, we're going to run the show
let's,
for a little bit.
Let's grow up now, child. You know, yeah. Like, it's been fun. You've had your run. You've been in the hospital. You've been in rehab.
You've been dead momentarily. Yeah,
you've been mostly dead. You know, little Princess Bride action.
Right.
Mostly dead all day.
So, I mean, overall, though, I mean, I think that that was a pretty interesting twist. And do we think they live happily ever after, guys? Are they back on drugs? I suppose we could contact Nico Walker and be like, how's it going?
Yeah, right.
Oh my God.
Inquiring minds want to know.
But if we just take them as two fictional characters, do they make it?
Yeah, I think so.
You do?
Yeah, I mean,
aww.
If she...
calls the romantic.
He's clean. I suppose if she's there... on
she
time.
Showed up at the right place at right. the right time, right?
After 14 years.
She could drive. She was good enough to drive.
Right. Then I'm assuming she's gotten her shit together. I'm assuming. I want to think.
Yeah.
I
well, with pills and coke out of the picture and Mr. Black fairly out of the picture, and now her you know, knight in shining armor not there to be able to continue.
She wasn't scoring her own shit.
And she wasn't even shooting up by herself. You know, most of the time she was asking him.
Right.
So I
and mean, can you do it for me? Like she wasn't able to do it herself.
Yeah. Real needles, guys. Real needles. I know. I just kept coming back to that, like, because that would really scar your skin. Like, geez.
Yeah.
That's a lot, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to think that Cherry and Emily are living a happy life. I don't know. The smile on his face at the end that she was actually there waiting for him was pretty priceless, gotta say.
Yeah. I'm hoping that they are having a happily ever after. It's deserved at this point. Like, they deserve a little bit of peace and happiness, I think.
I hope so. Maybe helping others.
But it's also something you got to work for.
And they did. Good Lord, we all did. All three of us here and every audience member. We worked
exactly.
for that ending, didn't we?
Yes.
Exactly.
Oh, all right, guys. Well, this is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Sheila.
Thanks so much for listening. Please go over to Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and rate, review, and subscribe so that people can find us. Check out Pod Clubhouse for many, many, many other podcasts. We'll bring you a couple of others from Apple Plus TV.
Such as For All Mankind, Ted Lasso, Dickinson.
There you go. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.